of the 53rd chapter of the 10th canto. This is called Krishna Kidnaps Rukmini. Shisuku Uvacha Vaidarbhya Satu Sandesham Nisamyaya Dunandana Pragya Panina Prahasan Idam Abravit Vaidarbhya Satu Sandesham Nisamyaya Dunandana Pragriya Panina Panim Prahasan Nidam Abravit Vaidarbhya Satu Sandesham Nisamyaya Dunandana Pragriha Panina Panim Prahasan Nidam Shisuka Uvacha Vaidarbhya Satu Sandesham Nisamyaya Dunandana Pragriya Panina Panim Prahasanidam Abravit. Goswami said, Vaidarbhya, of the princess of Vaidarbha, sa, he, tu, and, sandesham, the confidential message, nisamya, hearing, yadu nandana, Lord Krishna, the descendant of Yadu, pragriya, taking, Panina, by his hand, Panim, the hand of the Brahman messenger, Prahasan, smiling, Idam, this, Abravit, said. Sukadeva Goswami said, thus hearing the confidential message of Princess Vaidarbhi, Lord Yadunandan took the Brahman's hand and, smiling, spoke to him as follows. Please repeat. Sukadeva Goswami said, thus hearing the confidential message of Princess Vaidarbhi, Lord Yadunandana took the Brahman's hand and, smiling, spoke as follows. So this particular verse has no purport. There is a little comment from Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He comments that in this chapter Krishna goes to Kundina city and is worshipped by King Bhishmaka and steals Rukmini when she leaves the city to worship Durga. Rukmini was disturbed internally and externally by her attachment to the Lord. Krishna, however, though attached to Rukmini and moved internally, did not show that, and instead he smiled as he spoke. So Krishna is now going to speak about his feelings. The Supreme Lord said, this is the next verse, just as Rukmini's mind is fixed on me, my mind is fixed on her. I cannot even sleep at night. I know that Rukmi, out of envy, has forbidden our marriage. And then the next text, text number 3. She has dedicated herself exclusively to me, and her beauty is flawless. I will bring her here after thrashing those worthless kings in battle, just as one brings a blazing flame out of firewood. Purport. When latent fire is aroused in wood, the fire bursts forth, consuming the wood in the act of manifestation. Similarly, Krishna boldly predicted that Rukmini would come forth to take his hand, and that in the process the wicked kings would be burnt by the fire of Krishna's determination. Omagyanatim handasya janatyana salakaya chakshu unmilitam jena tasmai shri guruve namaha. So here we're hearing this pastime, and when I was looking at this story, I will continue to read from the verses this morning, I recalled how I felt when I first heard this particular pastime or this section of the Bhagavatam, the Dwarka Leela, how the first thing that struck me was it sounds a little bit like a novel. So of course for those of Indian origin, they have a little more respect naturally in their upbringing. But then there too they have the idea or the concept that this is some type of mythology. This word is a very well used word in India. This is the mythological understanding of the Supreme. For me, not having that as my reference point, I thought of my conception of God was somebody who was, well, coming from a Christian, Judeo-Christian background, he was definitely elderly. And he was very antiseptic and sterile. He didn't involve or disturb anybody's life. He didn't get he didn't have any emotional preferences, because if I would think it through, I would think if he has a preference for this person over that person, this isn't so good, because he might not even like me. He might prefer somebody else. So therefore, my infrastructure, my religious infrastructure was totally different than what I was reading when I was reading these pastimes. And so therefore, when I first read them, I had a little trepidation to accept them as the absolute truth, because he's saying, I cannot sleep at night. He's saying that I want to marry this girl. She loves me, I love her. What does it sound like? It sounds just like something that we might have seen on television. So there is something very much, 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 much deeper here than what our small understanding can bring forth. And I spoke about this when we were at the retreat, how something has to take place, and this can take place suddenly. It can take place early in your Krishna consciousness. It can take place very, very later on in your Krishna consciousness. But something has to take place. It's like a shift, a transition has to take place. And the transition, you can begin with a philosophical endeavor towards this. But then, after some time, it has to come from hearing about Krishna himself. And the transition is, and even in the first, in the introduction of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, Srila Prabhupada speaks of this, that in the spiritual world there are five relationships, that you can love Krishna in five different ways. And he speaks about it in a very simple way, because it's the beginning of the beginning book of spiritual science. In Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada is telling us the basic, what would you say, like the alphabet, the ABCs. Krishna is speaking to Arjuna, and Srila Prabhupada is elaborating and helping us to digest through his purports the most basic understanding of spiritual life. And what is the most basic understanding? What is the most basic thing? Who can say? Not the body. What were you going to say? Yes. You're not the body. You're not the body. And Srila Prabhupada would go over and over and over on this point, and it was as if it would sort of go towards our ears, and maybe it went straight through, or else it just seemed to reverberate off. It was difficult. It's very difficult to understand this most basic thing, that you're not the body. And why is that so important? Why is this primary? It's so important, and that's why we have to keep going back to it, even in our thought processes, that I'm not my body. And trying to see and analyze what we see through this premise over and over and over again. If you think it's hard work, it is hard work, because the whole world is revolving on the idea that you are the body. And the reason we have to work and work and work, pushing on that particular point, is because at some point the penny has to drop that everything there is not a reflection of here. That there is reality and here is a reflection of there. So why does this pastime sound something like what you might see in a story, read in a book? It has this romantic factor of a man and a woman and love and romance. The English, when they went to India, they were fascinated with certain aspects of the Indian culture, and they were particularly interested in the products that they could get from being in India, the spices and so on. But when they saw and read these transcendental literatures, they ran between two trains of thought. One was that this is mythology, it's there for the people, so they'll live a good moral life in this world. But some of it is not at all moral. Krishna's pastimes aren't at all moral. There he is, he dances in the middle of the night with other women's wives. So this doesn't fit into the conventional mode of how to live in this world a good moral religious life. This is very difficult. So therefore what they came to the conclusion was that Krishna is an immoral god. So many gods they have in the pantheon of Hinduism, and Krishna is particularly immoral because he's doing this, he's doing that, he's doing so many things that actually are inappropriate in modern society. So for them, modern society is their basis of reality. That means the body. And spirituality is something airy and vague up there, and when it doesn't conform to modern society's values, then we leave it aside. Or we criticize it. Mentally we criticize it, or verbally we criticize it. And the best, of course, the best insult to somebody is neglect. So we define it as mythology, mythological, and we push it off to the side somewhere, or we preach against it, as the British were fond of doing, and we put it somewhere so people will feel embarrassed that actually, how could I read these things and take this seriously? So Srila Prabhupada, because he had done his ABC work thoroughly. And why is ABC so important? Who can tell me? So many educated people. Why is ABC important?
The roots of reading.
It's the?
Roots.
It's the roots of reading. And why is reading so important?
Find out
about something. Find out about... find out about Krishna. Find out about, first of all, for the ordinary person. So they find out about something. They find out about everything through reading. Everything is coming through reading. So it's the roots of education, is this ABC. It's the root. Without that, you can't read. If you can't read, you can't learn. Of course, you can say you can hear, but then that person has to have read or heard, and somewhere you'll come to an alphabet. Even to speak, you have to have some understanding of what is taking place. So this is the root, is to understand that this is not reality. This is a shadow reflection of that. And when you get that concept firmly in place, then you become very anxious to hear about Krishna. Because now I want to know what reality is. I've been dazed by this world. I'm so much attached to the this and the that and the that and the this. And there's none of it that doesn't pertain to the reality. There's nothing here that isn't there, but imperfection there. And here is a perverted reflection, just as when you see a reflection of the moon on the water. Depending what temperament and what the water is doing, depends how clear the moon's reflection will be. If the water is extremely turbulent, which is compared to the mode of passion, the fragmentation of the moon will be extreme. You won't be actually able to understand what the moon looks like. You'll just see ripples and some light, and that's all. But you can see, if you're intelligent, that there is something being reflected here. then if you look up in the sky, you can see the beauty of the moon. So similarly, when we hear the pastimes of Krishna, if we understand this, that of course there's romance in this world, and men and women loving each other, and so on and so forth, because it comes from Krishna, it's a reflection, they're imitation. It's an imitation. An uneducated person, you can say, now here is a gold ring, and this costs $1,000. And here is a gold ring, it looks just the same. And this one costs you $20. So what would an intelligent person do?
Take the $20
one. Some intelligent people would take the $20 one. Some intelligent people would maybe ask, why is this one cost $1,000 and this one cost $20? What's the difference between the two? How about, is that a good question to ask? What's the difference? Because it's, you've got to have $1,000. We haven't taken the ring yet, but we want to find out about these rings. Because one is so cheap and one is so expensive. We would like to know the difference between them. And somebody says, oh, this one here is made of solid gold. And this one has just been dipped in gold and it just has a light touch. And don't wear it in the shower or anywhere else because that will just smudge off in a couple of days and you'll be left with a black iron ring. Then what does the intelligent person do? The intelligent person either says, well, I can't afford a ring. Or they think, well, I could get this one and I would use it in a very careful way because it's cheap, you know, and it looks like gold. And maybe if I preserve it intact very carefully, it will stay looking like gold. And if a person really wanted a long-term proposition, something of great value forever, they would say, I have to start saving my money to buy this one that's real. The other ones, it will do me for some time, or maybe I don't need a ring, but if I do, then I have to start looking at what it would cost. And maybe I can negotiate something. I can think if I have anything I can offer as well, I can do something, but I think I need this one. I need the real one. So this is what Krishna consciousness is like. It's like the real gold ring. And if we think that, I actually don't know if I can afford this, I don't know if I even have enough faith to actually achieve this, then that's all right. Because we're in the right frame of mind to gain more and more and more. The wrong frame of mind is when we're just thinking very quietly to ourselves, oh yes, this is just like a story, let's just read it. And I see sometimes, even myself, my mind will trick me like that, and it will not allow me therefore to actually enter into the subject matter. Whereas if I fold my hands mentally and say, I actually do not understand the nature of Krishna's pastimes, but I do understand that Krishna's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, from my hearing and reading of philosophy, and now I would like to hear more about him, then when I hear the pastimes of Krishna, they resonate much more. And that means that they're entering into my heart more deeply. And what that means, and this is the most important thing, is that imperceptibly they're making an alteration in my conception of God. And this is why we have to hear about Krishna. Because now I have my parents' conception of God is my conception of God. And so therefore it's somewhere back there. It's not like it comes to the foreground, but everything I hear rests upon it. I accept it and reject it invisibly on what I have been raised with. But I would like to change that because I see that it's inadequate. It's incomplete. So how to do that? Hearing. That more information comes in, and gradually, as I said, imperceptibly, we're accommodating more. We're accommodating a greater understanding. And then one day, when somebody says to you, you know, that's reality, and this is all like a dream, you can sort of say, yeah, I can relate to that now. Couldn't relate to that before. That was a dream, and this was reality, but the transition has been made. So this is why we need to hear. like we need vitamins and we need a good doctor and so many other things, we need very badly to hear about Krishna. So I will continue with this story, this pastime. Sukadeva Goswami says, Lord Madhusudan also understood the exact lunar time for Rukmini's wedding. Thus he told his driver Daruka, ready my chariot immediately. Daruka bought the Lord's chariot, yoked with the horses named Saibya, Sugrivya, Megapushpa, and Bahalaka. Then he stood before Lord Krishna with joined palms. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes the following text of the Padma Purana describing Lord Krishna's chariot horses. Saibya was green like a parrot's wings. Sugriva, yellow gold. Megapushpa was the color of a cloud, and Bahulaka was whitish. Lord Sori mounted his chariot and had the Brahmana do likewise. Then the Lord's swift horses took them from the Anatha district in Vidarbha in a single night. King Bhishmaka, the master of Kundina, having succumbed to the sway of affection for his son, was about to give his daughter to Shishupal. The king saw to all the required preparations. So just imagine, this is coming the night before. She has written this letter to Krishna. She has given, first of all, an expression of her heart's desire in a very humble way. And then she has become very bold, as we heard, like only a princess can do. And she has told Krishna how he can accomplish this act of kidnap. And she hasn't heard anything back yet. So now the day is about to arrive and Sisupal is coming, everyone's coming, all the guests are coming. And when you hear the list of guests, you'll see they weren't really very pleasant ones. Shuddha Swami points out in this connection that King Bhishmaka had no particular liking for Sisupal, but rather he acted out of attachment for his son Rukmi. Now he's preparing everything. The king had the main avenues, roads and intersections thoroughly cleaned and then sprinkled with water. And he also had the city decorated with triumphant arches and multicolored banners on poles. The men and women of the city arrayed in spotless raiment and anointed with fragrant sandalwood paste wore precious necklaces, flower garlands and jeweled ornaments. And their opulent homes were filled with the aroma of uguru. Purport. When the earthen roads are sprinkled with water, the dust settles down and the road becomes smooth and firm. In this way, King Bhishmaka thoroughly prepared for the great wedding, setting the scene for Lord Krishna's triumphant abduction of beautiful Rukmini Devi. O King, in accordance with the prescribed rituals, Maharaj Bhishmaka worshipped the forefathers, demigods and brahmanas, feeding them all properly. Then he had the traditional mantras chanted for the well-being of the bride. This is all going on just before the marriage. The bride cleaned her teeth and bathed, after which she put on auspicious wedding necklaces. Then she was dressed in brand new upper and lower garments and adorned with the most excellent jeweled ornaments. A short purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that only spotless, fresh clothing, straight off the loom, should be worn during auspicious ceremonies. The best of the brahmanas chanted mantras of the Rig, Sama, Yajurvedas for the bride's protection. And the priests learned in the Atharva Veda offered oblations to pacify the controlling planets. A short purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out that the Atharva Veda often deals with the pacification of unfavorable planets. So all these things take place in the Hindu culture, pretty much all today even, coming from this particular traditional way of doing things. Outstanding in his knowledge of regulative principles, the king rewarded the brahmanas with gold, silver, clothing, cows and sesame seeds mixed with raw sugar. Raj Dhamma Ghosh, now we're going to hear about the other side, here's the father-in-law, hoping to become, preparing everything from his side. This is Sishupal's father. The Lord of Sedi had also engaged brahmanas expert in chanting mantras to perform all the rituals necessary to assure his son's prosperity. Maharaj Damaghosh travelled to Kundina. He's coming accompanied by armies of elephants, exuding mada, which is some fragrant oil, some fragrant water that comes from the elephant's forehead. Chariots hung with golden chains, and numerous cavalry and infantry soldiers. King Bhishmaka came out of the city and met King Damaghosh, offering him tokens of respect. Bhishmaka then settled Damaghosh in a residence especially constructed for this occasion. Now here come the others. Sisupal's supporters, Salva, Jarasandha, Dantavakra, and Vidurat, all came along with Pundraka and thousands of other kings. Now all these names, anyone who has read the Krishna book knows that all of these personalities were inimical in some way or another to Krishna. So they had all come and they knew that people in general wished Rukmini to be married to Krishna. So they had come along, not alone, but with very many, many soldiers. Those familiar with the history of Lord Krishna's life will immediately recognize the names given in this text. The kings mentioned here maintained a deep animosity towards Krishna and opposed him in one way or another. But they were all to be frustrated and defeated on the occasion of Sisupal's would-be wedding. To secure the bride for Sisupal, the kings who envied Krishna and Balaram came to the following decision amongst themselves. These are all Sisupal's friends and his brother. They said, if Krishna comes here and Balaram and the other Yadus to steal the bride, we can all band together and fight with him. Thus those envious kings went to the wedding with their entire armies and a full complement of military conveyances. So they were all prepared, very determined. The word samhata, which normally means bound tightly together, may also mean thoroughly struck down or even killed. Thus, although Krishna's enemies thought they were unified and strong, samhata in the former sense, they could not successfully oppose the personality of Godhead, and consequently they would become struck down and killed, samhata in the latter sense. Now, this is, we're going to leave it on a suspenseful moment, so you'll all be anxious about coming tomorrow morning. When Balaram heard about these preparations of the inimical kings and how Krishna had set off alone to steal the bride, he feared that a fight would ensue. Immersed in affection for his brother, he hurried to Kundina with a mighty army consisting of infantry and of soldiers riding on elephants, horses and chariots. And Balaram is on the way, and Krishna has left alone, and he's even more on the way. And meanwhile, Princess Rukmini does not know what is her fate tomorrow. We will stop here. Thank you. If anyone has any questions.
What a way to get married.
What a way to get married. This is the way that all princesses... It's actually the way that, in a way, in a sort of a far distant way, this is the way that every woman dreams of getting married. Some man will come along and he will see her and he's completely overwhelmed by love for her, and he will force his way through all the obstacles and take her by force and can take her very happily away. And Srila Prabhupada talks about this. This is a romantic feeling that ladies have, and of course on the other side the valor with which Krishna is acting, the heroism is very attractive as well. So when we understand, as I said, this point of transition from that this is a dream and this is reality to this is reality and this is a dream, everything becomes easier, because then we see something in this world that attracts us. We can withdraw ourselves from it by understanding that this is just a reflection of real beauty. So why am I going to waste my time with a reflection? Just like yesterday, we were sitting taking prasadam, and we had the good fortune of spending some time with Korma Prabhu. So he said something which I couldn't actually give. It was quite profound, but we couldn't actually purport it. If anyone can think of a good purport, they can present the same. But he was explaining that if you stay upstairs in the Prabhupada's house, from upstairs, because we were sitting in the prasadam room, taking prasadam, and all of a sudden Korma went with his perfect style, and he said, "Oh, they've burnt something." And then he goes, "That's mustard seeds cooking, and they've cooked them for too long." And we didn't even notice any fragrance at all, but Korma had picked it up immediately. So then my husband was praising him for his skill in discerning fragrance. And then he went on to explain that if you just stay upstairs in that building, all the fragrances from the kitchen, they wander down the corridor and up the stairs, and they arrive upstairs. He said, "Have you noticed that?" And we all agreed, "Yes, we've all noticed that." And he said, "But it's very mysterious. If you go down the stairs and find out what's cooking, you'll find that it's already gone." And we said, "What?" And he said, "Just like I can be upstairs and I can smell, that's pakoras. They're cooking pakoras. And I'll come downstairs. But when the time I get to the kitchen, they're mopping the floor and cleaning up the kitchen. And you say, 'Where are the pakoras?' And I say, 'Oh, they're already in the van and on the way to the restaurant.'" So he said, "This is very profound. You're smelling it up here. That's reminding you of something you would like to taste. But actually, it's already gone. It's already out and gone by the time that you're actually smelling the fragrance. It takes so much time to make its way up the stairs and everything that the act is already done when you're aware of it." So this, he thought, was a little eerie. We were also thinking that this has something to do with the nature of the material world. Even when you find something, "Oh, this is going to be wonderful," it's already not going to be. And the same thing can be experienced if you ever happen to have kept a diary, or you read a letter that you have written a year ago, and all the things that you were anticipating, that you were hoping and that you were worried about, they've all gone. And then today I have a new set and I'm completely worried and absorbed in them, and if I don't take care of these things, there'll be something severely wrong in what I'm doing. But actually, a few days from now, those things will be gone also. Even if they're catastrophes, they'll be gone. So isn't this a little dreamlike? So this is how we have to view this world. This world is dreamy, and we have to do what we have to do. But we have to learn how to concentrate on reality. And actually, it's so much more attractive. But the difficulty is, and I speak for myself, so I assume this is a conditioned soul's dilemma, is that I'm very absorbed in this world as reality, and when I hear the pastimes of Krishna, they're entertaining, but I don't get the message that this has substance in reality and this doesn't. Yet, at the same time, when I read them, they're so much more attractive than everyone here. What do they do every day? They go to work. And what do they do at work? Nothing very interesting. And if they want to go somewhere, what do? They have to go on an aeroplane. It's not very pleasant on an aeroplane or a bus or a train. Krishna he can just be there. He doesn't have any constricting elements. If we could understand that this is also true of us, these constrictions that we find frustrating, they are frustrating. They're not meant to be like that. Then we too could enter more deeply into these wonderful pastimes. Yes?
The question it struck me, the fact that Rukmini's father is prepared to marry off somebody he disapproves of simply to satisfy his son.
His son.
How many sacrifices one child for another?
Let me see if it says anything with that.
And if you know that he's sacrificing.
Due to attachment to his son Bhishmaka consented to marry his daughter to Sisupal and then decorated the city accordingly. Well, you can say that, but then people also make bad choices, right? Even if they were given the freedom, they make bad choices. So good and bad in this world is unavoidable. So in this case, we can say this is a pastime, and King Bhishmaka is just making the appropriate arrangements so Krishna can come and take her away. It's more exciting this way than if he was to give directly to Krishna, his daughter. But there is also something of the culture here that's not understandable by somebody who hasn't been brought up in that particular cultural mold. That the culture was quite strict, and everyone followed it. And because everybody followed it, everybody survived the good and the bad in a different way. Modern society is very sensitive to anything that might impinge on somebody's well-being, right? Any difficulty that may occur, very, very sensitive to not, we disagree with anything that may be against somebody's will or some social distinction being made here against a woman, for example. But when you say, okay, then, all right, you do whatever you want, do it your way, how you want to do it, it's another cultural setting, and people get the same amount of difficulty or more from that way of looking at things. So it's not exactly how is he sacrificing, it's more like in the particular, if we take it to the mundane plane, this is transcendentally a pastime, we would say that in that particular culture there is a type of order, and the elder brother is like the father. So what he wishes, the father will often listen to that, unless there is something that he can recognize that he's very firm about. And then in turn, you would have to look at that culture. Because I lived some time in India. So anyone who's born in India, the culture is theirs. So they don't look at it. It's already inside them. Just as if an Indian person comes and looks at the Western culture, then they can examine it with some objectivity, because they're like Srila Prabhupada. He came to the West and he had a very strong perspective that you Westerners have no culture. Your culture is a so-called culture because it has no definition to it. Everyone can do whatever they want. This is not culture. Culture means there's a code, a system of dealing with things. So that system may prove, we may not like that way of dealing with things, or we may see the defects of that particular system. But within that system, the person who is brought up in that system has their means of arranging and working with their difficulties in the same way as in the Western culture. The Western culture means, if I don't like this marriage, I get a divorce. That's the gift of the Western culture. You can just, you know, get on with your life without. The gift of the Indian culture was a lot of great deal more forbearance and tolerance and religious piety, basically. Not that you know, makes a wrong right, but there's no all rightness in the material world. Any other points? Yes.
Just wondering if you could link up one thing for me. I attended your class on Sunday and you spoke of Narada Muni as his exalted disciple Vyasadeva. And I thought Vyasadeva compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam. And what I can't quite link up, because it's a Sri Shukadeva Bhagavatam, you know, Sri Shukadeva Goswami.
Yes.
So why?
Well, yes, I can. So basically, the Sukadeva Goswami is the son of Vyasadeva. And so when Sukadeva Goswami was conceived, he was extremely reluctant to come into this world. He didn't want to come out of the womb. And at one point Vyasadeva spoke the Srimad Bhagavatam that he had compiled and written down. He spoke it to his wife with the baby in the womb, with a hope to attract him to come out of this neutral position. He didn't want the good and bad of this world, so he wanted to stay here. So he wanted, please come out and don't be frightened of the good and bad. Take this instead. and think about this, and then you won't have to worry about the difficulties and the enjoyment and pleasure and threats of this material world. Instead, you ingest the Srimad Bhagavatam. So he gave it to Sukadeva Goswami. He came out. And then Sukadeva Goswami, he left. But he was containing within himself the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam just through hearing. So when Maharaja Parikshit, who was the king at that time, was in the last week of his life, he had met with a curse. Untimely, he was about to die. So he was also a great, great spiritual personality. So he sat down on the bank of the Jamuna River, Ganga River, it's also said, near Hastinapur, which is New Delhi, and he was going to just sit there in a yoga meditation and fast until he died. However, many, many, many people came to see this because he was such a dignitary. And he left his family, gave the kingdom to his son, left all his royalty, all his royal robes, everything. He just separated himself. So then they came, all these personalities came to see him. And then he asked them a question. He asked them two questions. He said, what should one do with his life? What is the most important thing to do with one's life? And what is the most important thing to do if one's about to die? And so they all wanted to bless him with their knowledge. So they spoke many, many things. But it was inconclusive. Like I might say the best thing to do is meditate, and someone else says it's very good to sit upright and do some asanas, and somebody else says so many things they advised him. He wasn't satisfied until Sukadeva Goswami arrived at that spot. And he sat down, and immediately everyone there, the king and everyone, honored Sukadeva Goswami. Even Vyasadeva was there. And he didn't speak. His son spoke. And Sukadeva Goswami began to speak. Now, in that group of people who were listening to this discourse where Sukadeva Goswami is speaking to Maharaj Parikshit was one Suta Goswami. He was one of the people that was there. Also a great son of a great... His father was one of the people that Vyasadeva put in charge of a branch of knowledge. There were many branches of knowledge. He put his father in charge of one. So he was an elevated young man as well. But he heard Sukadeva Goswami speaking to Maharaj Parikshit. And then later, quite a long time later, not so long, he went back to the place where he came from in Namasharanya. And there they were having a yajna because they could see that Kali Yuga was coming, and what could they do to help all the poor people who were going to suffer? Just like we're hearing about poor women who suffer, say, in a difficult situation of marriage. So then one might think, what can we do about that? That's so bad. It's not that we just philosophize it away. We have to do something. What can we do? We might think to pass some laws or do something like that. But these sages thought that the best thing we can do is have this long sacrifice and postpone Kali Yuga, push it back. By the strength of these religious, spiritual, good activities, so that it won't affect the people as badly. So they were doing that, and Suta Goswami came. So they asked Suta Goswami, please, can you enlighten us? And they gave him six questions. What is for the good of people? What is the essence of all good? Please tell us about Krishna's pastimes, about his incarnations when he comes to this world, and how is the whole world created? And what should we do now that Kali Yuga is coming? Where will we find any religious principles now? Look at the world outside. Where do you find religious principles? Where have they gone for shelter? So Suta Goswami starts speaking to these sages, and as he's speaking to them, he's telling them what he heard Sukadeva Goswami tell to the king. And while he's telling what Sukadeva said to the king, he's saying that Sukadeva told about when Vidura, who's another great personality, met Maitreya. And so you'll find there's a whole canto or more where you're hearing Vidura Maitreya Uvacha. They're speaking. And their speech is part of Sukadeva Goswami's speaking and answering Parikshit Maharaj's question, which is coming now down to Suta Goswami's answer to the sages. And it's all coming from Vyasadeva. And then it comes down, you can say, in disciplic succession like that. So we hear Srila Prabhupada speaking about all of these personalities. But it's very nice to have a kind of a sense of the overview of what's going on. Otherwise, for years and years and years together, I used to read the Bhagavatam and who's speaking now? Who's that, you know? And then one day I sat down and I said, I can't figure this out. And I sort of went through it all and finally I got a kind of a picture of what's taking place. So that helps. That kind of, you know, what would you say, personal research is very helpful. Okay. Yes. Say again. He wrote. Yes, but if you read in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, you hear when he starts to write, he has a vision. That's why Narada Muni said, you should write it, because your vision is perfect, so you can write this down. So he had a vision, and in that vision he saw the personality of Godhead, and he saw Maya standing behind. So if he can see Krishna and he can see Maya standing behind, most definitely, because we know this word Trikalagyan, he can also see the future. And also these pastimes take place cyclically. But he's not an ordinary person, Vyasadeva. He's empowered to do this work. So he doesn't have the limitations that we have in our intelligence and our capacity. Anything else? Yes, Prabhu.
In Rukmini's case and also Draupadi's case, we always see that Krishna only saves them the last blink of a moment.
Yes. Why does he wait till the last blink of a moment to save them? Well, how about Prahlad Maharaj? How many times did Hiranyakashipu try to kill him? Well, in a sense, you could say that. Well, there's a very nice, we have not time now, but at the end of the 10th canto, there's a very nice commentary on a verse, I think it's in the prayers of the personified Vedas, or else it's in the story of Ritasura, where it explains why is it that Krishna sometimes waits till the last moment to save us. Because from our perspective, we think it'd be very nice if we just sort of went, help! And there he cleaned it all up for us and everything was all right. And then we would say, thank you very much. You can go now. And on we'd go again, and then another problem. Help! There he is, he cleans it all up. But it's not very exciting. He sounds like a butler or something, you know. He just comes in, you drop something, he picks it up, straightens it out for you, and life goes on again. But it's not very adventure filled. So Krishna doesn't do that because his nature is that he enjoys rasa. Rasa means a taste. It means something that's right exciting. So life would be kind of boring if there was no rasa in it. That's what makes people, there are different kinds of rasas, we know from the nectar of devotion. And if you examine the different kinds of rasas and you have a look at the world, you'll see everyone is going for those things. They're already described. It's not somebody analyzing the world and writing it down. It's somebody telling you about transcendence again. Here it is again. And then you have a look and you see everybody, they're just doing that. The horror movies, right? Mm-hmm. All the this, the that, the fighting, the wrestlers, the war. People like war. They don't like it if it's them who are involved, but they'll watch it on television. They like to hear the news. They want to know all these things. They want knowledge. They want to feel they know what's going on. These are all characteristics of the soul filtering through matter. So there's excitement in the spiritual world. My concept, given to me by my family religion of heaven, it was quite pale. It, you know, people had wing, you know, you float around all the time being good and probably have to be kind of like going to church all the time. Because you have to be good all the time. It's really bland. And so therefore what happens? So you give someone an idea like that of that's as a small child. Okay, that's what heaven is like. And then they look around and see there's so many dynamic things happening in the world. Who wants that? Mm-hmm. You know, like there are too many distractions from such a pale destination. Rather not go there. So Krishna's pastimes, they're full of life. And when, whilst he's taking his time to go and see Draupadi, Draupadi isn't fazed by that. She's thinking of him more. It's not like she's thinking, oh, he's not coming, what's this, you know, what we would think. But because we're so insipid, we're sort of, our faith, our taste is very insipid, we're absorbed in matter, and, you know, and there's a little bit of something in it, but compared to this, there's really nothing. So we don't have really a strong sense of rasa, but Krishna does. And he reciprocates and plays with his devotees in such ecstatic ways that when we gradually we get the right idea, then we learn to dive in a bit. So this is why the acharyas are passing down so much information to us and saying, please, please, this is where Krishna has gone, this is where religious principles have gone for shelter in the Kali Yuga, in the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that is why he doesn't just end the story in a moment. There'll be a good fight. All right. Thank you very much. Oh, one last question. Yes.
Can you say that the pure devotee always thinks Krishna's hand in everything?
Yes, a pure devotee always sees Krishna's hand in everything. Yes.
Whatever happens, yeah. He always sees that. Yeah. And Krishna is waiting for the climax.
The climax,
and,
yes.
And Draupadi, yeah.
You know, no movie will become a top movie in the world if it doesn't have some violence, and it also has to have a man and a woman in it. Right? Otherwise it won't go very far, unless it's a sort of a family movie. And we have those two. We have the cowherd boys all playing together and doing very sweet, playful activities for that level of entertainment. But for those who like the other, Krishna has, everything is there. So imagine how short movies would be. A movie isn't also, you can't write a play without conflict. If I say to you, do you agree? You say yes, and I say yes, that's the end of the conversation. So when somebody says, I don't agree, I think that's nonsense, then you have something to just go backwards and forwards about. There's some substance, and everybody listens. Ah, you know, let's see how they work this out. I saw one time in the Philippines where one man got up really angrily to make some criticism of Srila Prabhupada and something he had said. And Srila Prabhupada was so artful, he let the man speak, and everybody, all of us who were there, young disciples, we wanted to stop him. He was an elderly Indian man, and he was getting more and more offensive in what he was saying. And Srila Prabhupada just let him speak, and we were like, and he let him speak, and at exactly the right moment, because he was so rasic like that, that expert in making the situation what he wanted it to be. So the whole audience had to sort of, first of all, get thoroughly disgusted with the man. You know, if we got up as Westerners and said something quickly, we would look very young and impudent, and it's not our culture. So he waited and let the man speak and speak and speak and speak, and then at a certain point he said, there are two cases of this, this might not have been that one, but at one point he said, have you finished? And the man said no, and he wanted to say more. He went on and on and on. And Srila Prabhupada said, have you finished? And the man finally, he hadn't had any more to say, and he said yes. And the Prabhupada said, then sit down. And everybody cheered. You know? I mean, he could have chosen to, you know, but this was another way of doing it. So the Prabhupada had life. Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna.